This is Natasha Taschuk interviewing Colonel George Olson on 21st November 2007 at his home in Victoria, BC. So let's start off with some basic information, George. When and where were you born?
Antioch, BC. 22nd of February 1931.
Okay. And that's north of Prince Rupert.
North of Prince Rupert.
Okay. Were either of your parents employed by the military?
No.
When did you join the military and in which branch of the service?
In 1951. And I joined the Army.
Mm-hmm. What made you want to join?
Korea.
Korea?
Yeah.
Really? You're just interested in it for political reasons?
Well, it was just, I was in senior matric in high school at the time. And some of my friends joined. And so I finished senior matric and then I joined. Mm-hmm. But I didn't go to Korea, obviously.
Yeah.
No, I was selected at that time for officer candidate school, which they ran in Camp Borden. Mm-hmm. And so I got a short-term commission that way. Stayed in the Army till retirement.
Mm-hmm. Long career, hey? 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. When were you stationed with the 4CMBG?
From 1953.
Yeah. Let's go CIBG first. 4CIBG, you were in...
Yeah.
Stationed
from 55 to 57.
Yeah, okay.
In Hamer.
Yeah. And then afterwards, you were stationed with 4CMBG in which years?
Well, actually, 4CMBG really didn't happen until they moved to Laura.
That's true, yeah.
Otherwise, it was 4CIBG throughout that time.
Okay.
And so my next posting in Germany was with 1SSM from 69 to 70.
Okay. And then you were with them when they moved south?
Yes. Then I was posted to headquarters CFE from 73 to 76. And, 73.
Yeah.
And then NDHQ from 73 to 76.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What was your rank when you were sent to Germany with CIBG?
Lieutenant.
Okay, and then when you came back from CIBG?
Well, I was still lieutenant.
Still lieutenant. And then when you went in 69, what was your rank? With SSM battery?
I was a major.
Major. And then when you came back in 73?
I was still a major.
Still a major. You got promoted when you came back?
Came back.
Yeah. Okay. And when did you retire?
Well, actually 1980.
Okay.
But I quit working. I started working for NATO by that time because took all the unextended leave that gave another 4 or 5 months. Mm-hmm. So actually, my record of service is 1980, but it was 1979 I quit.
Okay, let's move on and talk about weapons system and procurement. What kind of weapons were you provided with in 4CMBG?
Different weapons. But the regiment had 25 pounders, and that's about all. You know, just.
Those were British. Were they British gun?
Yeah, well, they went back to Korea. Well, they went back to the Second World War. The first brigade that was deployed in North Ag, Canadian Brigade, they had the M109. But then when they moved to the Hamer-Zost area, they went back to 25-pounder because at that time, with the British Army of the Rhine, it was a matter of logistics. You know, they had lots of 25-pounder rounds. And so we were the last actual regiment to use the 25-pounder.
Okay.
But this is this is just something I picked off the net.
That's
somebody who had visited our brigade And basically, the rundown of weapons in there and units is about right.
That's awesome.
But you can see the size of the brigade was over 6,000. And that was more or less like a small division.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they had a lot of firepower, a lot of flexibility, good weapon systems.
How did the size of the brigade change when it moved south?
Well, you know, everything was reduced in size, so it was really just sort of a normal brigade.
Yeah.
And this one, and of course they had the SSMG. Mm-hmm.
That's true.
So when they moved south, it was a mechanized brigade.
Mm-hmm.
Like one of the battalions became what they called a mechanized commando, so they were highly mobile. And then the artillery regiment got the self-propelled
gun.
The
howitzer.
Howitzer.
Okay. So what training? Let's actually ask this question. Canada had access to Honestron rocket launchers up to 70. No. Up to 70. Were these nuclear weapons available to 4CIBG or 4CMBG? Who was in control of them? What were the safety devices? What sort of protocol was there around them? You can talk any area you want.
Well, we had Honest John warheads, which are training warheads, and launchers, you know, with both 1 and 2 SSM. But we didn't get nuclear support until 1964.
Mm.
Although 1 SSM was first in Germany in 1961. But they had a lot of training up to do between the time they arrived in Germany and their first nuclear surety inspection, which was in 1964. From 64 to 70, we had full nuclear support.
Okay.
Although every year you had to be recertified and pass the nuclear surety inspection.
And what was the inspection? What was it entailed?
Well, just to give you an idea about the unit, it was the only army unit of the Canadian Forces that was really tested by another country.
Wow.
It was, and while we were with the 4 Brigade, we were a brigade unit, but in terms of targeting and operational control, we came under one British Corps, and I think it was the 2nd Division.
Mm-hmm.
If we deployed to our GDP positions, we would have deployed with the brigade. But the targets that were selected for us, if we ever went nuclear and fired rockets, that was under the control of the division because they selected the targets. But then, I don't know quite how I should answer the question.
Let's keep it simple. So we did have the rocket launchers, and between 64 and 70 we had full nuclear capability.
That's right.
Okay. Who was in control or possession, shall we say, of the actual nuke?
Well, we never had a nuke. Nobody handed us a nuke.
Tactical nuclear weapons?
No. Our designated weapons were in special storage, very near Hamer. Those weapons were controlled by the Special Ammunition Command in Heidelberg, SASCOM. And the only time we would get release of those weapons is if, in fact, we deployed, because there was going to be a war. But we always deployed with our training warheads, which were just a flash smoke weapon. We had to fire those under supervision every year, a special firing camp, which was run by the Corps. They set up the deployment for us, and it was just very much like it would have been if we had deployed to a GDP position to go to war. It was known as an Army training test. Now, the requirements for that test were set by the United States Army Europe and the 514th Missile Group. So we had to pass an Army training test every year so they were comfortable that we could deploy somewhere and put a rocket on a launcher and fire it accurately. Because that always involved firing, and we used to do that on the Hohner ranges. But part of that exercise was a readiness exercise. All the units in Germany had readiness exercises. Like, we had a brigade readiness exercises where in the middle of the night they'd call up everybody, and we had a system of contact, you know, either by telephone or by knocking on people's doors, and you got back to your unit lines and you got in your vehicles and things, and you deployed out to an area ready to move forward. But we also had a special one run by Corps for us. So we had, and that was much more stringent because we had to simulate moving out of unit lines with all our vehicles and launchers. And we would move to an area and simulate picking up our nuclear weapons being released. Then we would move to a hide area, wherever in the boondocks. And we would set up a no-loan zone, which we cordoned off an area. The weapons would be inside. There would be an area between an outer and inner area, and that had to be constantly patrolled. And part of our team was a platoon from one of the infantry battalions. They deployed with us and gave us protection. So that was that sort of exercise we had to go through. So we were probably tested in more ways than any other Canadian Army unit. And in all cases, if we had failed a core readiness test, or if we failed the Army training test, or something had happened when we were up there doing our firing, we would have been in deep trouble. In fact, one CO had a launcher fall off had the rocket fall off the launcher. It wasn't really anybody's fault, and that witness was investigated, and it was just one of those things. Mm-hmm. Had nothing to do with, but he still had a year to go, and he refused to take his unit out and fire another weapon. He was scared, you know.
Really?
And on the nuclear surety side of it, it was probably even more, gut-wrenching, because if you failed, if you got a major deficiency, nuclear support would have been taken away from us. The first one was run in 1964, which gave us nuclear weapons. And there was an open telephone line between the regimental area in Hamer and the Prime Minister's office, because it was so important. They never... I think one other commanding officer had, on an NSI inspection, had a deficiency which they couldn't make up their mind whether it was just a minor deficiency or a major one. And they suspended the test for... Just to give you an idea of how serious this nuclear business was. So they suspended the test for 48 hours. And powers that be in 514th Missile Group, our Army Artillery Group, the U.S. body we really belong to, they decided it was a minor.
A minor relation.
A minor, yeah. So that's basically it.
So this sort of protocol, in the event, were there ever any rehearsals carried out, say, stimulating... okay, the balloon went up. What's the protocol?
What happened?
Yeah, what happened if the balloon went up?
We would, of course, get all our vehicles together and our infantry support. We would have gone down to the special ammunition site. We would have outloaded our nuclear weapons on our vehicles. And off we would have gone. There would be concentration areas where all of the forces in Force EMG would have just poured into these various, and then from then we would deploy to our positions, along the Weser.
What sort of, how were the weapons transported from the special holding area? On trucks?
All the warheads would have been on a state truck. Mm-hmm. But we had four launchers, actually was reduced to two by the time I ended up putting the thing to bed. But those four launchers would have a rocket body on it. Mm-hmm. And we would also carry extra rocket bodies. But one thing I maybe should cover is what happened during a nuclear surety inspection.
Yeah.
Well, you had to simulate all of the things, but you only had to go down to the special ammunition site, and what you would have loaded, simulated, was a nuclear weapon, which we called a black.
Okay.
It was a special round. It simulated exactly what a nuclear warhead was like, but it didn't have, of course, the explosives matters in there. And that had to be taken, put on a truck, and then the truck had to be escorted to the unit lines. And that simulated all of the weapons, but anyway, you got the truck. So when it arrived on unit lines, the inspectors would check the truck. They would check the truck. They'd check everything. They'd check the springs, the tires, the tire pressures, the tire tread. They would check all the little hoses and things in vehicles.
Wow.
They'd check the engine. They'd check fan belts. If they found a fan belt with a little nick in it or something, that could have been a major deficiency. The important thing was that the equipment had to be absolutely up to snuff, because you couldn't afford stalling a vehicle or a vehicle carrying a nuclear warhead stalling. I mean, everything had to be checked. And then our launcher vehicles also had to be checked, and the launchers themselves had to be checked. But the most important part of it was the black. The black was in a special box. You had to take the unpack that black, and then you had to go through the process of arming the weapon, then mating it with the launcher, loading the rocket and warhead on a launcher, and then reversing the whole order. Mm-hmm. We had to do it by checklist. There was many things that were required, and it was one of the most frightful things for our technicians, because if somebody dropped a wrench, and it wouldn't have done any damage, of course, because I think they said you could probably drop that thing from 100 feet onto concrete and it wouldn't do anything. But anyway, this is just part of the test. So they had to be especially careful, when they were undoing bolts and things, to make sure that there was no contact with the metal. So, and then you had to go through the process of arming the weapon as much as we could arm it. But it's like pretty well all nuclear systems, it's a two-man system. And it's like the two key systems they had on intercontinental ballistic missiles. Like, they had to, two people separated, and their arms weren't long enough to put in two keys, so it was just a safety effect. But in our case, we had to arm it as we could. And then the little support detachment we had that would have deployed with us in war came in and did something which would have allowed that weapon to be fired, and it was called PAL.
PAL, okay.
And all of those nuclear weapons had PAL, which was a permissive action link. So they'd go in there and do something or other. And we didn't know what they did. That meant that, they had to do the final arming of the weapon. So when we, if we deployed in war, and even on exercises, we'd have our little detachment along with us. And so when we did these things in the field, even with our training rounds, you know, we went through the same drill because everything was just drilled into us. I mean, we had to do every single step, the requirement. Well, nuclear weapons are nuclear weapons. So that's basically...
Yeah, I'm glad you added that.
And basically that's what we did in the nuclear business, and it was very important to us. And we never had a real problem. Lots of countries had problems. Lots of countries had Honest Johns. I think in one case they hadn't sort of unlocked the launcher, so when they fired the weapon, it took the truck with it down the firing range, and then it sort of blew up. So that's about it.
So did SSM Battery have like its own mechanics and people who were keeping the trucks maintained?
Oh yes.
Yeah.
Well, we had our own mechanics, but also we had a Remy unit in the brigade.
Yeah.
But we pretty well looked after our vehicles, so as everybody did, really.
Yeah.
I mean, preventative maintenance was the name of the game. In the brigade, maintenance was really important, and once a year the brigade ran a technical inspection where they went through all of your equipment, all of your vehicles, all of your radios, all of those things, and you were graded on those. So I must say that in that last year, we topped the brigade. Yeah. And also our last NSI, there was, after I took the unit, I went to see the brigade commander, wanted to see me, Jimmy Gardner, and he said Ottawa thinks that since we're getting rid of this, the battery's going at the in 1970, the end of the year, they don't see any reason why you should do any more firing, shouldn't shoot any more practice rounds, just sit in the concern and do nothing. And we didn't have to do the NSI, because you're always really working about a year ahead on those. So I said, might as well quit today, because the unit wouldn't have had very much to do. And so he went back to Ottawa and said, bugger you, and we did everything as if the SSM was going to go on forever. That's about it.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk a little bit about how the SSM battery was disbanded. 1969, you're there in charge of 2 SSM, was it?
Yeah.
Okay. 70, with Trudeau, he decides to move south and disband SSM. What happened? How did it get disbanded? And then how?
We just turned all those weapons into the logistics units, and some of the stuff was sold. Sold our rocket bodies.
Mm-hmm.
We sold our black. In fact, there was a 50 missile regiment just down the road from us. They had both Honest John and 8-inch.
Yeah.
And they used to borrow our black to do their NSI.
Huh.
because they knew it probably the best. So I think they actually bought that, but they just sold it. They just sold the stuff.
They just sold the stuff. And then was the rest of the battery just redirected to other...
Oh, well, they just went, a lot of them went back to Canada. And others were, you know, there was rotations in regiments. So a lot of them went back to Canada, and others went to the regiment and in the brigade.
After the SSM was disbanded, because up to that point it had always been foremost that in the event of Soviet aggression, tactical nuclear weapons would be used. Do you think it changed any sort of perception in terms of how Canada would combat the German or Soviet threat in terms of being more geared towards conventional warfare? Or, like, how did disbanding SSM and moving south change Canada's role or Canada's view of itself?
Well, I suppose a lot of us probably thought that it was a dumb decision. We should have carried on with the rest of the, until, you know, the Soviet threat, you know, calmed down a bit and, you know, you could get rid of nuclear weapons because it would have been madness to use them in the first place. But to do what Trudeau did and Hellyer, putting us into green uniforms, and Trudeau was just arrogant about these things. In fact, you know, even when they were going to buy a new tank in the 70s, and Trudeau didn't even want to buy a new tank.
No.
And Jay Dex, General Dextras, went had a chat with him, I think, and said, "You better buy a new tank." So we got the Leopard.
Yeah. Finally, the Centurions were just about ready to.
Well, they actually were still in good nick.
Were they?
Yes, they were in good nick. And I think that they had what in NATO what they called the Canadian Army Trophy Competition.
Yeah.
You've heard of that one?
Yeah.
And I think the Armored Regiment won that with the Centurion in 19, I think it was between 1976 and 79.
Holy.
Yeah. Well, the guy who commanded the regiment was a guy named Clive Milner.
Yeah, heard the name.
Yeah, and but you can check on that, but I'm damn sure, because I remember writing a letter for my NATO ambassador to Clive, who I know very well, and congratulating him on that, because,
wow.
You know, that was... a lot of American units have won it. I think it's gone out of, that competition has gone out of existence, but it was really a super one. And like the Brits bought a new Conqueror, got rid of all their Centurions, and then but the Conqueror had their weapon system. They had to load the damn thing in two parts, and they lost time. You see, you just couldn't just ram a shell up there and fire it. You had to ram the shell and then put in the bags of whatever. I'm not sure about that, but I know that it was a two-part loading proposition, and so they would never have been fast enough to win that sort of competition with the Conqueror.
So as commanding officer of SSM, what kind of knowledge did you guys have about the effects of nuclear warfare or tactical nuclear weapons upon humans? So in terms of fallout, radiation, that sort of thing.
Well, I don't think, you know, we had no special classes. Mm-hmm. Because if you have that kind of class and what you're trying to do, well, they don't really need to think about those things.
Yeah.
If you're in the military, you've got a job to do, they give the weapons to do the job, well, then you're going to do the job. Mm-hmm. But you don't want to start sucking your teeth and saying, well, you know, is this really morally right?
Mm-hmm.
So we never sort of had that kind of, those kind of classes. But we did, in fact, instill in them respect for the opponent, because there's no question that the Soviets were very good at what they did, and they had an awful lot more soldiers than we did, and a lot more equipment than we had. Because they, we had officer symposiums in the brigade where you talk about these things. And everybody knew, in the context of, they used to, you know, review the GDP, the general defense plans every year. And everybody knew that if it happened and the Soviets came pouring through the full gap, we would have deployed to the Weser, hopefully. And maybe there would have been nuclear release, but we wouldn't have stopped the Soviets, because that their initial tank army that would have crossed out of East Germany through the gap and spearheaded for the Rhine, they had about 80,000 troops in there, which was about the same as all of the Allied troops deployed in Germany. And of course, one of the other things, nuclear weapons could have made a big difference. But, you know, if you start with a small yield nuclear weapon, under those circumstances, it's going to escalate.
Oh, yeah.
And then it would have been sort of game over. I think everything would have gone to hell. But we didn't really want to think about that, and we didn't talk about it. We just said, okay, this is what we're supposed to do under certain conditions, and we're bound to do it.
In the mind of you, your men, and everyone else there, was there ever any question about the possibility of using tactical nuclear weapons if the Soviets rolled, or was it just assumed that they would be used automatically?
Well, the yield of the Honest John's is classified. Actually, if you searched online, you'd probably find all sorts of yields. But it was a Dali yield type weapon system, and as far as I know, and I was cleared for all sorts of stuff like that, especially when you were in the unit, the weapon had three yields, and one was very low yield. And then there was sort of a medium yield, and then there was a high yield possibility. But I think on both sides, if nuclear, if we'd gone to war, nuclear weapons, they would have started with very small weapons, around a kiloton or less. And that's just a big bang. And when you're talking about fallout and things like that, you took all sorts of things into account to prevent creating obstacles for yourself, like blowing buildings down or tree blow down or that sort of thing. And, you hope the wind was blowing in the right direction for fallout. But normally these weapons were exploded above the ground, where you're going to have the least fallout. Because fallout is really the stuff that...
That's true.
Yeah. So you fired the cleanest shot that was possible, and I'm sure they would have started at very low yield. But after that, I mean,
it's kind of one of those things. As soon as it's touched off,
it would have run away with itself.
Yeah.
I think.
Okay, here we go. During your tour in Germany, did you notice any fluctuation? And I'm speaking to your second tour. Any fluctuation in the emphasis that was put upon conventional versus nuclear in terms of political encouragement or defense budgeting? Well, clearly, it was shut down in the 70s, so...
Well, I don't think we ever sort of worried about that.
No.
That was up to the politicians to decide.
You had your feet on the ground, and that's...
That was it.
Yeah.
The Honest John was a... very simple system and very good system. Mm-hmm. Very accurate. Would have done a good job.
Now, was the Honest John available for the British as well?
Well, they had, Well, they had Honest John.
Yeah.
And the Dutch had Honest John.
And
all sorts of people had Honest John.
And the Germans.
Yeah, I think the Germans had Honest John.
So
it's a very common weapon. The Turks had them. And,
okay. So we used them in conjunction with the Americans. We had the same holding spot as the Americans, or.
Well, the special ammunition site, our special ammunition site, served us and 50 Missile Regiment, and I think that was about all. They had them all situated as close as possible to nuclear units for ease of outloading and moving on to war.
So in 76, Ottawa purchased the Leopards to replace the Centurions. Do you know, or can you comment on the differences between the two tanks, maybe the improvements that the Leopards had over the Centurion?
Well, you should ask an armored guy about that, but I think that the Leopard tank was a far superior tank to the Centurion, from what I know about it. But one of the main factors is that it was an awful lot lighter.
Yeah.
The Centurion, I think, was about between 50 and 60 tons, and I think the Leopard's somewhere around 40 tons.
Mm.
And that was one of the biggest problems, is weight, because there are so many bridges to cross between the Rhine River and the Weser when they're deploying, and even on exercises. In fact, when we were thinking of buying the Leopard tank, there was a competition between the Leopard and an American tank, because everybody thought it would be a great idea if we had a standard sort of NATO tank. And of course, every time the Leopard came through with flying colors, the Americans changed the rules. So they ended up buying an Abrams tank.
Yeah.
Which is a huge, bloody monster of a thing. And, anyway, we bought the Leopard. And now we're renting them from the Dutch because they've got air conditioning. And that's another matter, because I don't think they're really useful in Afghanistan.
The Leopards?
Hmm?
You don't think they're useful, the Leopards are useful in Afghanistan?
They should buy more artillery. You know, we used to have hundreds of guns. And now what have we got? We got about a dozen of the new M777s, which is a fantastic gun. Highly accurate. All the rest of it. I think $30,000 a round. But we need a lot more artillery, and we need a lot. You know, we don't need tanks in Afghanistan, I don't think. Anyway.
It's funny, everyone I've interviewed so far, when we start talking about the Leopards and Centurions, we get into Afghanistan inevitably.
Yeah.
But I guess they're looking at Leopard 2s now, too, for Afghanistan, right? So.
Yeah, Canada's going to buy some new tanks.
Yeah.
Well, that's one way of getting the weapon system, but it's a conventional war-type weapon system.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Afghanistan is a whole other problem.
That it is, yes. That's
a whole other discussion.
Let's talk about this one. When CIBG moved south, what do you know about how our other weapon systems changed? I mean, we got rid of SSM. What about other weapon systems? Or is there anything you can comment to me? Because you're the first person I've interviewed who was there for the move. Is there anything you can tell me about any subject, really, that highlights the difference?
Well, it was very odd, to say the least, because it had an infantry brigade group, mechanized brigade group, on a couple of airfields. You know, that's not normally where you find, you find them. And we were a long way from the GDP positions, but essentially we had a different role. We definitely had an offensive role as part of of the British Army of the Rhine, but there it was a reserve role. Mm. But I mean, they just got in there and they got themselves sorted out, and they did their exercises, and they changed their organization a little bit to conform more with the American, mm. like the brigade. The brigade was still commanded by a brigadier general, but the senior staff officer in the brigade under the British system we had for so many years was called a brigade major.
Oh, really?
So he was, and now we have a special, now we have this senior staff officer who was a lieutenant colonel, and they made some little glitchy changes like that. Mm-hmm. But they had a good role, they exercised. And the Americans had some big exercises where they would bring some of those units over that they'd come over, pick up their equipment, and then move forward to GDP positions. Mm-hmm. And all their equipment was pre-positioned. And then they would go into an exercise phase. And I think and it would have been in about 72, on one of those big exercises, the brigade under General Schwinnart at that time was the enemy, mm. acted as the enemy, and he completely, well, they had the, you know, that when you write an exercise and you create an enemy to test your units, you check it all out and you think this is the only thing they'll do, and then they're prepared to check it out when it happens. You have umpires and all that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. Well, General Schwinnard just looked at the map and his guys, and they checked out a lot of these tiny little roads through forests and things, and they sort of bypassed and then hit this American division in the flank, and they were completely surprised. None of the umpire staff knew how they could possibly get there without being seen or heard. And they stopped the exercise and sent the Canadian brigade back and said, you know, follow this scenario.
That was 70s. 72, sorry?
Yeah, I think it was 72.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
If you could ever find General Schwinnart, you should interview him.
Do you know how to spell his name, actually?
C-H-O-U-E-N-A-R-D, something like that.
Yeah.
Schwinnart.
Hello.
Hello.
Should we pause it for a second? Should we pause it for a second? If you would like to say hi, you can.
No, it's okay.
Okay, don't mind us. Thanks for having me.
No, that's just totally fine. Get on with it. Yeah.
Thank you. Okay. I'm going to talk a little bit more now about Canada's role in the NATO Brigade. As a man on the ground, and you were there from the 50s right up to the 70s too, so you can maybe even talk about different roles or how you felt differently, but what really was Canada made you feel that they were part, they were contributing to the NATO Brigade or the defense of Europe?
Well, I think it was really an essential unit until they went south. Mm. I mean, they had an important GDP position on the Weser. They were probably as well trained or better trained than any other units in the British Army of the Rhine. They were highly respected. And, you know, they were proud of themselves. Good soldiers.
Yeah. And did any of it change?
No.
South?
When they went south, yeah. You know, as I said a little earlier, they adapted very quickly. Oh. And did an outstanding job when I was there. And in fact, I went out and did some umpiring during, in fact, I ran a brigade exercise for General Schwinnart. That means that I ran an umpire staff. Mm-hmm. And then we went out and tested them in various things. And they were really good. It never entered my mind that we were doing anything other than the best and taking an integral part in the defense of.
So would you say that you feel Canada's presence in Germany was essential to the stability and defense of Europe?
I think the BAOR was pretty sad to see us go.
Yeah.
Because they had to fill the hole. And it was a considerable one because, you know, the size of our brigade.
Yeah, over 6,000.
Yeah. It was a very powerful organization.
Okay. I know you were with the SSM, so I don't know if this question can be specific to that or more general, but what were Canada's specific responsibilities in the event of Soviet aggression? So, like deployment areas or zones of responsibility?
No, we would have just deployed and put positions behind the Daser, and they were all selected, pre-selected, and every nuclear unit knew where they were going and had an idea of the targeting that may have been involved. It was just as simple as that.
And then in LAR, it was, you would go to a holding zone, and then it was...
Well, and then, yeah. That was one of the biggest problems, and it was played down a lot. Because we weren't on the line. We had a long way to go. In fact, all the NATO forces had a long way to go to the forward positions, for the forward defensive positions. And they had a lot of tanks, and you know, they had a lot of vehicles, hundreds and hundreds of vehicles. And in a crisis situation, what would have happened, of course, is every road and trail would have been packed with vehicles. Civilians would have hopped in their cars and they would have been trying to drive to the channel. Mm-hmm. It would have been a total mess. That sort of scenario was debated often. And it was so simple, you know. I mean, you see all these shows, they take out a map and they say, well, we're going to move from A to B and we'll travel along this route. And then it would have been just about impossible. And then we knew there was a whole bunch of Soviet supporters in Germany, West Germany. And they probably had just about every bridge targeted. Yeah, I'm sure they had them.
And that would have just decimated.
Well, then, well, we'd never made the GDT positions. And, I mean, that was debated. Now, I'm not putting my reputation on the line. I'm just stating the fact that I believe that we wouldn't reach that, our GDP positions. Because there were two scenarios for a Soviet attack. We would be given some warning in terms of their preparation. But that's scenario one. Scenario two is they just got up one morning, everybody loaded up in their concerns and started driving for the Fulda Gap and the North German plane. And they would have been there before us. A lot of the buildup of the tank army was fairly close to the East German border, East West German border. So, but we, you know, when things are difficult like that, you just don't think about them. You just don't want to think about them. But we had a lot of, as I say, we had a lot of symposiums and people talked about those things, and there's no solutions except hope, you know. We would get proper warning. So it would have been a very, very difficult situation.
And thank goodness it never came to that.
Well, yeah.
What sort of ideological background, if any, were you provided with by the military in terms of Soviet communism or Soviet history? No. Tactics? Logistics? Strategics?
Well, I don't think they did things much different than...
Yeah.
I mean, every army pretty well does the same things with slight variations. Mm. The Soviets did an extremely heavy amount of their training on bridging.
On bridging.
They had, I'm sure you could find somewhere the order of battle of the Soviet forces. Mm. And because there's even coming out of the Fulda Gap and heading for the Rhine, they would have had to bridge the Weser. Mm. And there's all sorts of other little streams there, but the north, you know, if they came out, if they attacked also north, which they would have done, there's all sorts of canals and rivers again. And we know they did tremendous bridging exercises all the time. They were highly mobile, and they can put up bridges probably better than we could, because we didn't have the demand for them. They weren't part of our defensive requirement. So I think they're really well respected.
And kind of on a different topic, to what extent did you feel welcomed and or integrated into the German community there?
Oh, they were great.
Were they?
Yeah. At least in our brigade area, there was the odd little punch up in the bar, but generally speaking, they liked the Canadians.
And, yeah.
And when we moved south, they were very happy to get us in Lahr,
mm-hmm.
and we built up a very nice reputation with the Germans in Lahr before we finally left there. It was a really nice part of the country,
mm-hmm.
too.
Mm-hmm. How do you personally feel about the way things swung when Trudeau came into power in terms of defense cuts and...
Well, guess that's what politicians are paid for.
I know, but how do you feel about what he did and how it affected the military?
Well, you know, I think... Well, I think everybody was trending, all the politicians were trending that way, because, you know, we first did our NATO build-up, we were really sucking a lot of money out of the national budget. I think we put a very large percentage, far larger than we're spending now, was coming out of the budget. So, you know, they're always looking for ways to we needn't taking the brigade out when it did.
You're welcome. That looks nice.
Sorry.
No.
You know, there probably wasn't any necessity.
Yeah.
And of course, what happened when everything came back to Canada, then we started to reduce everything in Canada.
Yeah.
I mean, really, we've virtually nothing left. We can barely... produced 2,000 soldiers to put them on the ground. You know, we've got a lot of these artillery guys are really excited about this new gun, this new howitzer. I think there's must be less than 10 of them they bought. Maybe it's 14. I'm not sure.
Mm.
But nonetheless, we had 5 regiments of artillery. When we came back from Germany, we went to close to Petawawa, 4th Regiment. And we had 24, 3 batteries of 8 bona fides,
mm-hmm.
and we had a battery of 8 medium towed guns. I was a troop commander of one of those troops. And we had a locating battery. And we had an ROP flight. And, you know, the strength of that was, I don't know, pretty close, 500, 600, 700, 800. Yeah. Now what have we got? We've got zip. And we still got, you know, I think, we at the lower rank levels talked about it a lot, but I think we still got over 30 generals, you know.
When you had over 30 generals, when was that?
Pardon?
When did you have over 30 generals?
We still got them.
We still do, yeah.
We still do. I mean, they don't need that many.
That's for sure. Okay. At what point, or was there any point that you felt things were changing with the Soviet Union, or relations, or the nature of the Cold War was changing?
I just watch the news.
That's, yeah. Did the threat seem just as prevalent in your tour there during the 70s, late 70s, as it was during the 50s?
Oh, no, I don't think so. No. I think things were pretty serious after the war, until NATO got on the ground, until they decided how they were going to defend themselves, to the buildup of nuclear weapons. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, reason started to prevail over time, and on both, in both sides, the Warsaw Pact and NATO. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they eventually sort of went down the tube, and until some chap, Gorbachev, came along.
Gorbachev, yeah.
And sorted things. But, well, I think it was expected, but I'm sure that there were times when nobody really knew what was going to happen. And that's, I guess, what we were trying to prevent all when we were, when NATO had all these forces.
Mm-hmm. In summary, kind of overarching question, from the time you began with 4CIBG until the time you left with 4CMBG, can you comment on the most significant changes in terms of weapons supply, or in terms of what you think Canada's direction was, or Canada's role in NATO?
Well, I think Canada's role in NATO was on a descending curve over time. Because in around 54, 55, when they reconstituted the 1st Canadian Division, and that was after our 1st Brigade came out of Korea and posted to Germany, and we gave NATO a commitment to have a division, a follow-on division, with one brigade forward deployed, which was the NATO brigade. And we also had a special brigade designated, which eventually became the Gas Combat Group, for NATO employment in the northern region, in fact, in North Norway. But then, you know, first Div was pretty exciting. We were all excited to be part of that first division. And, you know, we went to Gagetown for that first division concentration. I guess that was in 55. And then next thing you know, it's gone. Mm. And then next thing you know, we started to renege on our larger commitments to NATO. And we ended up with our brigade in Europe, which they always kept pretty skookum. But the Gas Combat Group was the rest of our commitment to North Norway, and it probably never would have got there anyway. Mm. Although they did go over there and exercise periodically.
Yeah, they did, yeah.
And it was important. But really, it's just keeps going. The attrition keeps going. And right now we have, in my opinion, very good soldiers, very well trained in the units that we have, mm-hmm. and they're doing a hell of a job in Afghanistan. And they did, before Afghanistan, they did a tremendous job in about 37 yeah. peacekeeping missions around the world. So they're always highly professional, but right now, they've got a zip. You know, when you think you need a four-star general to command about, I don't know how many, what the total force is now, but it can't be very, very much, and most of them probably civilians. You know, all our maintenance is done by civilians. And so it's really, we don't have Canadian Army any longer. We don't have a Canadian Air Force. I mean, even, you know, most of those jets are on the ground
yeah.
90% of the time.
Yeah.
What have we got for ships? I mean, they're designed to find submarines. You know,
yeah.
they're not a warship
yeah.
at all. They're really quite useless. They had a use during the Cold War.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have them any longer. Of course, all through the Cold War, we didn't have submarines until we did get those bargain submarines from the Brits. Which, you know, are molding away down here. I think we've got one that can go to sea. You know, for people like myself and all the guys I grew up with and the guys I served with, we're all getting pretty long in the tooth, so we like to gripe a lot. But from what we've seen when we joined the forces and what we have now is just unbelievable. They got much better uniforms now, but there ain't enough of them. They have better helmets. They got far better radio sets. I mean, high tech. Everything's high tech. When we went to Germany, we're still using the 19 set, which was designed by the Brits, and it was a pretty iffy thing. And we didn't have new radios for the 2 years, 55, 57. We were still using the 19 set.
Wow.
It worked fine.
Yeah.
It worked fine. But now, I mean, you could do better with the cell phones, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was vacuum tube technology.
Vacuum tube technology.
Yeah. But anyway, things were good. I mean, we had very good equipment, adequate mm-hmm. equipment. We got better rifles going down the road. We got better this and that. But that's normal. You know, you improve your forces over time. But then you reach a point where you start getting rid of them.
Mm-hmm.
Well, then that's not so good.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that we got rid or we downsized Force MBG prematurely?
Well, I don't. From a political standpoint, I don't really think so.
Mm-hmm.
But from a military standpoint, I think NATO was probably quite disappointed
mm-hmm.
because and I know quite a lot about that because, as I say, I did 8 years in Brussels, and the main job of the international staff was to try to convince nations to do more every year to meet the force goals that were set for them by the senior allied camp, by Sackler, Sackland, and Singchan. And, you know, keep their defense spending up to a reasonable level. And so it was, that was a tough slog, too. So, but it's inevitable. Military forces are costly. Yeah. Do we really need one?
What did we then?
Well, I think I needed one, and we needed to be up front during the Cold War. But now, and I've always, this is my own personal view, but I think that they've done a wonderful job in the peacekeeping field. And I have know something about that because I did a peacekeeping tour in Cyprus.
Did you? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Do you know Colonel Phillips.
Phillips.
Well, Gary Phillips. And who else did I talk to? Who did I talk to within Cyprus? Bob Peacock?
Oh, I know Bob Peacock.
Do you know Bob Peacock? Yeah. And then Dave Walters, of course.
Yeah. Yeah.
Was Colonel Walters in Cyprus, too? No.
No, I think he did a peacekeeping tour.
Yeah, he did. I can't remember where it was.
I don't remember where it was.
Nice guys.
Yeah.
I was curious. When you moved down south and you moved into headquarters, what were you doing there?
Well, we were trying to convince the Air Force that it wasn't a bad idea. They didn't really like it at all. And sort of integrate ourselves.
Integrated force, yeah.
Yeah, because the Air Force had always been all by themselves, and at one time they had a very substantial Air Force. They flew over 300 aircraft at one time. And now they're not flying so many. So they did a little reorganization. Yeah. They still had the two air bases. The operational squadrons were in Baden, and the mechanized command, that's where its home was, and the rest came down to Lahr. And they created, they no longer had an air division, so they called it the First Canadian Air Group. And I forgot how many aircraft they had, but not too damn many. And the air group headquarters was headquartered right in headquarters CFE. Actually, it was combined. It was the air group, CFE itself, and the base, because we're on the base concept at that time. So for the first while, it was a bit of a chore. And actually, I was first posted there to the base. And I was base plans officer. And like we had a lot of plans that sort of went down the tube. Like we had plans for getting all our civilians back home, for example. Now we had a reasonable plan up north, but we didn't have any plan down there. And there was all sorts of other little plans like that. And then the headquarters had a responsibility, as a sort of a nuclear responsibility. And I was given that job too because I had a nuclear experience. And what that meant was that if they ever had a broken arrow, in other words, if a bomb fell off the pylon on an aircraft, then I would be responsible for taking the necessary action to, et cetera, et cetera. But I finally talked myself out of that talk. And then, because all these little plans had to be coordinated, I finally found my way up to the second floor, the headquarters building, started working for Paul Manson. And Paul knew an awful lot about the Air Force, but he knew very damn little about the Army.
Really?
And so it was an educated process, because after the brigade headquarters had moved down there, Paul was the senior staff officer, but he hadn't even walked across the parade square to talk to them. So anyway, I got to be a bit of a pain in his butt, but we finally got him over there. And the fact that later on we got him on exercises. And he started to enjoy himself, you know, and wear a beret and that kind of stuff.
Actually be integrated a little bit. Yeah.
So, but the problem when we first arrived there was that we had an Air Force general who commanded CFE, General Laubman. Well, then we got an Army general. A friend of mine, and I can't think of his name. Anyway, And that he was very good. They had a new base commander. You know, the first base commander was a Colonel Gordy Sellers. I don't know if you've heard of him.
I have, yeah.
But anyway, he was replaced by an Air Force colonel, a base commander. And General Leonard went in as the commander CFE. Now those two had been friends for years because they were when the Canadian delegation to NATO was in Paris. They were both posted there as younger officers. Yeah. So when General Leonard went in there and General Sellers went away because he really didn't like the Air Force. And they didn't like him either. No, but it was sort of childish at some of the things that went on there until they finally got settled in. And like one of the first things we had to do when we arrived down there was do a recall exercise, and we had a whole drill for that up north, but down there we had nothing, and we were just moving families into some quarters that were available, but a lot of them had to go out into the economy and live in little towns and things. There wasn't that many that had telephones, but the Air Force had a recall system, and they had a power pause, power activated warning system, a little black box. And so they could press a control in the concern, and it would send a signal to all the people who had these little black boxes, and then they would go out, and it sort of spread out.
Yeah.
And anybody hop in their cars, and in some cases had to be picked up, bring them into the air, for the air guys, had to all bring them into the air stations. And for us, you know, it was brand new because we're living on two air bases. They wouldn't give us any of the pause. So, that's not our part of ship, you know, you'll have to sort that out yourself. And so the delegation had to go and talk to General Laudman, who really saw the merit of coming up with some solution to that, because some of these warnings were called by the Central Army Group. That was the first. That was actually the first recall under Central Army Group. So there was all sorts of little niggly things like that that had to be resolved.
And that's kind of, you were helping out with that.
I was planning. Intimately involved in that.
Yeah. Wow.
Well, we had to sort of rewrite. You know, there's a system in NATO where, as certain things happen, everybody knows what they have to do, and they have roughly the same sort of thing, but it wasn't quite the same as us. Like the army, so we have to bring those two things together again. And then we had early, not too long after we had integrated down there, we had the first Wintex exercise. You've heard of Wintex exercises?
Yeah.
Well, we had no coordination. Now, we've got the land element down here and an air element. We've got the air had no problem. They knew exactly what they did during Wintexes. And they had excellent communications because they were using microwave?
The waves, yeah.
Yeah. But we didn't have anything. And there was no op center.
No.
Well, they had, the Air Force had their op center.
Yeah.
No sweat. We didn't.
So was one
so we had
created?
To, yeah, well, yeah. We had to, Paul Manson
and
myself and a number of others. From the brigade and that, we, because, you know, CFE now was a whole, air and land. So everything they did and everything we did had to be sort of coordinated. So anyway, we managed to lash up the center. And we operated, and at the end of it, we wrote a report, and a lot of changes had to be made, and then Ramsey Withers took the brigade.
Yeah.
And Ramsey's Withers, who I know quite well as a really a bright guy, and he sorted that, all that out, and had a proper op center mm-hmm. and all the rest of it. Mm-hmm. But we had no way really of getting in touch with NDHQ even during that first exercise. But actually, looking back, it was sort of a lot of fun mm-hmm. in a way.
The beginning of something very new, right?
Yeah.
Well, that's really neat. This brings us to the end of the questions I've had prepared. So is there anything else we should talk about?
No.
In relation to the sort of tactical nuclear stuff that was going on in Zos?
Well, I forgot to mention one thing about the SSM. Mm-hmm. And it also applied to the air nuclear. Is that every one that was close to or involved with nuclear weapons had to have a human reliability program rating, which had to be checked every year. So, you know, nobody who drank too much or so all soldiers that were artillerymen who were selected for that had to have a really clean slate. They always had to keep the nose clean in the unit, because if they didn't, we could suspend that.
Yeah.
And that could apply to officers too. But we probably were worse than them at times. But nonetheless, it was just another little.
So how did you determine whether or not they had a clean service?
Well, their record of service.
Yeah.
And you, when they were selected, they were checked. Mm-hmm. They were checked out.
So people were selected for membership in the SSM. It wasn't, they didn't join it directly.
Okay.
Yeah, okay.
Now, first off, when the Light Anti-Aircraft Regiment folded, and they formed the nucleus of the soldiers who were going to serve in 1 and 2 SSM, we didn't worry too much about that. And then, actually, it wasn't until 1964, when they passed their first NSI, that part came into effect. But I just added that because it's just one more thing, because it was, well, it was a simple system, and we did it all pretty well. The fact that it was nuclear and it demands a lot of things that other units don't ever have to
face. Not at all.
Yeah.
And as commanding officer of the SSM, what specifically were your duties? Like, were you in charge of planning the exercises?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Just running things, making sure the whole unit was organized.
Full responsibility for the lot. But I must say, 2SSM was a piece of cake, because there was no nuclear at all. But that's where we trained them up for replacements for 1SSM. Mm-hmm. But we also, we did shoot our rockets a couple of years in Shiloh.
In Shiloh, yeah.
And we did the only cold weather shot they'd ever tried. We had, you could use the Honest John in Siberia. So in Shiloh winters, much like that sometimes.
Yep.
But anyway, we decided to do one of those, and that means we left them out for outside in the cold with heating blankets on, because it came with heating blankets.
Did it?
Had never been used either there or in Germany. So we decided to do it, because it was the last chance.
Yeah.
So we did it. And the shoot was absolutely fantastic, because we took it out there and went through it. And when that thing went off, there was a ball of crystals, just like a huge ball of crystals. And then out comes the rocket. It was a great shot. And then we our last round, we took it outside the range area. We were out, you know, so that we could do a shot maximum range. So we did one about
35 meters,
100
meters, yeah. Holy.
35 meter shot. That wasn't allowed, but we got away with it.
And that was the last one you guys did?
That's the last shot we had in Shiloh.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the last shot in Germany, we had a huge barbecue on the Hohner Ranges. We just finished our exercise, and General Gardner fired the last Hummus shot. And that was great.
And that was it for the Canadian capability. And did the Americans still have? What did the Americans have nuclear wise after that?
Oh, they Americans?
Yeah, like after Canada got rid of their new tactical nuclear weapons. Did Americans?
Did someone fill the hole?
Exactly. Thank you. I'm not being very eloquent.
No. Well, I don't know. But they had lots of...
They had lots of them still.
Oh, yeah. Lots
British.
Of, yeah, and the British.
Yeah.
Yeah, 50 missile head. But they know the commander of 50 missile ended up working on the international staff and defense planning and policy.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, guy named Tony King Carmen.
Wow.
So we used to shoot the breeze about us nuclear gunners.
That was really
neat.
I met
him there, and then when I turned up at Mayo, he was working on the international.
How many years later was that? Like 10?
Oh, that would have been 69 to when I went to the delegation, actually. Well, it would be 76.
So, yeah, eight years.
Yeah.
Wow. Small world, hey?
Yeah.
Good. Well, that pretty much wraps it out. So if I could get, George, just get your oral consent on the recorder that it's okay to use what we've talked about today in the writing of the paper and some research.
Sure can, yeah.
Good, thank you.
And any sort of questions you might
have,
just email me and I'll research some for you.
Okay, so on the topic of nuclear release.
Yeah, well, we had a series of envelopes kept in a safe. And if we had ever had to deploy, we would take these envelopes along with us. And at a certain stage, we would get a message, either passed by that small detachment, mm-hmm. or say from division or corps. And we would open an envelope, and then we would go and see our little detachment commander, and he'd have an envelope and he'd open his, and if it had the same code word, that means a weapon would be released, and the weapon shortly after that we would have got a MIP weapon on yield, but that would have allowed us then to meet that weapon and set the yield. Because they were dial yield, those weapons.
Mm.
The warheads are dial yield.
Yeah.
You know, they have to be. From very small to very large.
Yeah.
Simply because, you know, it's like you don't use sledgehammer when the flies water.
Yeah. So, was that part of the practicing the nuclear release involved in the exercises you carried out?
Well, just. We didn't have code words or anything. We would just go through the drill, so we all understood the drill.
Yeah.
We would have some phony envelopes made up. Mm-hmm. And the real ones never left the safe.
No.
And periodically they were changed.
Were they? Okay.
Yes. And like in the Caserne, Fort Capel,
mm-hmm.
Caserne there, our doors were all barred and windows were all barred there was the one area that was totally barred, where nobody but us could go in there. In fact, we wouldn't even let we only had about four or five people that we would allow in there from the battery.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it was all very, very tough.
And one other question I had, I forgot to ask you, was just simple. How many people were in the battery? How many people were you commanding?
Well, I think I still had about 250.
Did you really?
Yeah, but that's... It was larger than that when they reduced it from mm-hmm. four launchers to two.
Mm-hmm.
And then my predecessor, Jack Crossman, he manned three. So we did the same, three. So we'd go in the field on exercise, we'd take three mm-hmm. launchers. Although we didn't have the people supposedly for them, but yeah. We managed all right.
So with three launches, you take 250. Yeah.